Thomas, Ross, Paddy.
Matthew Stephen Espoy, you sound a little off there. You okay?
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Am I talking to Matt Boyle here?
Oh, sorry, Tom. Matt Lexer, stop. Tom, we haven't podcasted in a while, and that's mainly been down to me. Admittedly, things beyond my control. But I've been working in my spare time, while I've not been podcasting, on an AI, and I call it Matt Lexer. And I was just thinking, if I'm not here, well, thank you. Hopefully I don't get sued by Amazon. But, you know, it's totally nothing like any other thing on the market, so I'm told by my lawyers. This thing, I hope, will be able to step in and podcast for me if I'm not here, so our listening audience can get something out of it. Do you want to try it? Hang on.
Yeah. Let's give it a go. Let's see how charismatic this thing is.
Matt Lexer, boop. What's your favorite video game? I love that Yakuza.
Okay, well, it's got that right. Yeah, it definitely knows you, Matt. You've definitely taught it well.
Thank you, Tom.
It's a little surreal.
What do you mean, Tom? What is love? Oh, shit, I gotta shut this down. It's Tom and Matt Attack.
What is love anyway?
Baby, don't hurt me. Oh, no, I went the other way.
No, I was doing Howard Jones, isn't it?
I think I was... Who was I doing? That? What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me no more.
Yeah, that one. Anyhow, Hadaway. You're right.
Yeah, I'm not bad. Sorry. We did just start recording this podcast. And as part of that, while we middled over some stuff of you having people at the door, I kind of apologised, as I just did in the intro a little bit. Some stuff has happened in my personal life, some family related, some medical stuff. Fortunately, I am fine. It is okay. But yeah, that's why we haven't podcasted. So I just wanted to apologise for that up front.
I was a little worried when you brought out Matt Lexer, thinking, you know, oh, this is in case you can't podcast for some reason. Are you okay? Are you healthy?
Thomas, I'm okay. Yeah? I will tell you that I'm okay. You sound through my window was the sound of Matt Lexer, Tommy. No, I'm okay. Everything's all right, I hope. But no, I'm all good in the hood, like I said. Just some family stuff and then some stuff after that. But it's all good in the hood, we hope. And
it's under control, anyway.
That, I will let you know, but no, it's all good in the hood. And last week was purely a thing of me feeling quite negative towards some of the video games I was playing, and I was like, I need a bit more headspace away from these things that are happening to make sure that my feelings for this video game are truly my feelings for this video game, and not.
And this
just
video game is.
Oh, which one do we want to get into? Let's start with Yakuza Like a Dragon. So, Tom Parry, the day hath come. Well, it came a while ago, actually. It was around the launch window. But I have a copy of Yakuza Like a Dragon. I'm still awaiting on my limited edition one from Pix and Love. But I buckled and I purchased a code. I bought a code off of the eBays. And now I have a copy of Yakuza Like a Dragon. And, well, I've played it for about 14 hours. And if I'm totally honest with you, I don't really know what to make of it. Right. For those of you who don't know, Yakuza Like a Dragon is a JRPG for a change. The Ryoga... Oh, God, I can never remember the blinking name of the Yakuza studio's name in Japan. Essentially, the studio had decided, okay, we've made these games for a long, long time now. As you know, through listening to this podcast, I've played through a lot of them. A lot of them exist. They wanted a clean break. They wanted to show that they could make something more than an action game, so they made Yakuza Like a Dragon, which is a JRPG, and it is... unashamedly a love letter to JRPGs, which is quite interesting. You play as a new character. You are not Kiryu Kazuma anymore. You are playing as a character called Ichiban.
Is it called Like a Dragon for a reason?
Like a Dragon is the name of the game in Japan. Yeah. That is what Yakuza is called in Japan.
I wonder, like a Dragon. You know, I know you haven't explained exactly everything about the game yet. I wonder if there is a reason why Like a Dragon. Because this game isn't like older Yakuza games, is it, Matt?
No, it isn't. And it's very interesting because of that. Like I said, you play as a new character called Ichiban. He is very likable. I will say that wholeheartedly down for Ichiban. He is, whereas Kiryu is very, like, stoic and very strong man, and Kiryu is a good protagonist for the same reason that Tintin is a good protagonist. I'm sure I've shared this on this podcast before, but, like, the reason Tintin is a good protagonist is that he is... There is not much to his character other than the fact that he is a journalist. Like, all of the Tintin comics, the reason that those are good and Hergé was a master of storytelling is because Tintin is almost a blank canvas and the world around him is so strange and unusual that when you mix him into that, it creates a compelling character because he's able to see through that and kind of be a proxy for the person reading the comic who can't really do a lot about the situation because obviously they're reading a comic book, they're not there in real life. Kiryu has that. As opposed to being a journalist who's asking questions, Kiryu is a Yakuza member in the Tojo clan who wants to fight and do all these things for honor and what's right and all of this. Ichiban is completely the opposite. And the reason this game is a JRPG in the first place is Ichiban is a massive Dragon Quest fan.
Like a dragon?
I mean, yes, potentially, like a dragon.
Because it's not like Yakuza. It's actually saying it's like Dragon Quest more than it is like Yakuza.
That's a good angle on it. To be honest with you, I had assumed before you said that that they'd called it Like a Dragon because that was the Japanese game of Yakuza, like that's what the translation titles to, and I had assumed that they were calling it Yakuza Like a Dragon to say, like, okay, we're going back to zero, forget all you know of this stuff.
Oh, of course, now I remember, because you know it's the same title as the film.
Yeah. Which is, yeah, like I said, it's tying the Western and the Japanese title together. Yeah. But that makes more sense. I like your theory more, Tom Parry, because when I say that Ichiban likes Dragon Quest, I don't mean that, like, there are vague references to Dragon Quest. He flat out says, I really like Dragon Quest. And so when you get, like, party members join, because there are party members, it is an RPG, it'll make the Dragon Quest, like, party noise or something that's very reminiscent of it. And he'll mention slimes and he'll talk about leveling up. He'll call himself the hero, which is the name of the protagonist in all the Dragon Quest games.
Because in Japan, Dragon Quest is synonymous with RPGs.
It is.
It? More so than maybe Final Fantasy is. I think over here, Final Fantasy's got more of a reputation.
Yes, I would say so. And I think that they are both equally big in Japan, I think. That's the reason why Square Enix is Square Enix and Enix didn't just buy Squaresoft outright. I think there is something to
be said. They're on the same level,
They are the god tier, but I do think Japan in particular has a preference towards Dragon Quest because that was the biggest one. It is the super collaboration, obviously, of Enix making great RPGs and having Akira Toriyama do the artwork. There's a lot going on.
Sorry, was it the first one? Did it come before Final Fantasy? Dragon Quest.
Do we know? Final Fantasy, from if memory serves me right, not by much, but it did. It is the original. And yeah, God, I could go down a whole tangent of the history of Dragon Quest, but I'm not going to. All you need to know is this is a straight up JRPG, and because of Ichiban thinking of himself as a hero, battles are now turn-based because this is kind of how he sees the world as he is a protagonist in a JRPG. He goes about his business and he starts off by, like, you just being in fights and you have fist fights and everything else. And as the story starts to progress, you start to realize, oh, actually, there's a job system to this. There's a party system to this game. And it gets to a point where, after the story progresses to a certain point, Ichiban starts to at the start of battles, enemies who are just like, you know, drunk people or Yakuza or homeless people or whatever start to turn into not regular people, but like almost JRPG takes on those people. So like, there are suddenly like arsonists and they've all got like hoodies pulled up over their eyes and like Banksy style with a flaming bottle in their hand.
This and sounds fun, like a real world RPG, like all those flavours of the traditional fantasy style RPGs wrapped up in a sort of real world package.
Yeah, it is. And to be honest with
modern
you,
day, shall I say.
It's for better and for worse, is what I will say. As everyone knows, I love the Yakuza games. For the first couple of hours I played this, I really, really did not like the combat. The combat in this game is... it's got a little pinch of a lot of things, to be honest with you. But the main three things for me that this game kind of takes after is definitely Dragon Quest, for obvious reasons. It's turn-based battles, but you're in a 3D arena, so there's a bit of Tales in there as well, but I would say it's more in line with the new 3D Dragon Quests than it is Tales, because it's not... there are some active time stuff, but I would say that actually that's closer to the Mario and Luigi series and Paper Mario in lieu of that, in that you are in combat... but you are pressing buttons. There are button actions that kind of correspond to the old Yakuza combat. So when you are doing a charged attack in the game, you have to press the triangle button at the correct time as you would in a quick time event, or the square button, you have to mash it quickly to build up power to get additional damage from attacks. But while I say, like, oh, Dragon Quest and Mario and Luigi games, because you also have to block with the circle button in time, the other game that I cannot help think influenced this game is definitely South Park, The Stick of Truth. In that a lot of where they take the enemies and a lot of, like, the goofiness of... the attacks and the weapons and everything else feels like that South Park game.
That was also a stand-up of fantasy role-play games in a modern-day
real-life environment,
real-world setting. Yeah,
and like, to be fair, like, they could have not played it and they could have just drawn the same conclusions, but it seems weird to me that they wouldn't have. My issue with that stuff, though, specifically. The turn-based battle stuff and, like, the Mario-Luigi-style battle system, a la Paper Mario as well, I think also Stick of Truth, from what I remember, had, like, you need to press buttons at certain times to defend and block and whatever. Is okay. I've gotten used to that now. Like, I really, really do miss... I was telling you on the phone when we talked last week, when I was in battles, I was pressing square myself when Ichiban was hitting people, because I was just like, I just want to just get in there and let rip, especially as I wasn't having the best time last week. I was like, I want to feel some weight of my button presses, and I wasn't getting that. But the issue is, this is a Yakuza game, and yes, Yakuza games are ridiculous. Yes, they're in Zero, you work for a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant that is owned by a chicken. Yes, you have... done lots of things, and like, one of the first challenging side quests I got in this game was a piss wizard. Like, there are weird
things. Sorry, Matt.
Yes, a piss wizard, Tom Parry. I shall not elaborate more. You will see it is a very early submission in that game, that there is a man who has the ability to control his pee via magic.
That sounds like Conker's Bad Fur Day.
Yes, but I mean, Yakuza is no stranger to the absurd, and Yakuza is no stranger to these things. The weird thing about it is, though, and is still a problem, I cannot shirk, like, 6 chapters in, 14 hours into the game, is that the story is quite serious. And the story is trying to bite off some really meaty subjects, not only about, like, the usual Yakuza melodrama and the fact that, like, Ichiban is essentially a shonen jump protagonist. He is very, like, yeah, power of friendship, I'm going to save the world, as you'd imagine from someone who idolizes the hero in Dragon Quest. But it's also got this weird thing to it, right, where the first two chapters of the game are about life of being a homeless person in Japan and how you can't really get government support. You can go to a job interview, but they won't give you a job because you're homeless, but you're homeless because you haven't got a job. And talking about some of the, like, the difficulties with that system and how the homeless people survive by being in an illegal community and the harsh reality that is life on the street and like having to like forage for money and collect cans and do all this stuff. And it talks about like the seriousness of all this. And then the first battle you get into, there's someone called Hungry Hungry Homeless. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost as if the people who were doing like the battle system and the enemies weren't really talking to the writers of the story.
Mm. And so, like, so the two things are at odds with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And like, likewise, I need to look up the character names because they are not sticking with me at all, bar Ichiban, because I know that means number one and he keeps making jokes about it.
So another difference is when you have a party of characters accompanying you, they are on screen with you all the time and you're walking around their doorways. Yes, that must be quite different.
I mean, it is to some extent. But, like, you have had missions in, particularly in Yakuza 6, where you would have people who are going to story things with you and would follow around with you. They just wouldn't be really involved with combat
much. I've experienced something like that in Zero, actually, yeah, where you have a character following you through an area, perhaps.
Yeah. And so, like, there are different characters. And at the moment, I think there are only four. And I'm just trying to get their bloody names, because honestly, like, I've spent so much time doing side stuff the last, like, 4 or 5 hours I've played it, that you don't really interact with the characters that much. Like, there are things that you can do to, like, boost the level that the character likes you. But mainly it's about Ichiban and, like, the world that he is in.
Not by winning them toys in a crane game.
I mean, there are certainly some subquests in which you need to win characters things from a crane game, but that's not the main thing. That is not the main crack of what you are doing as you go throughout this game.
Where does this sort of take place? It takes place after the events of Yakuza 6.
It does, yeah, and it clearly has that separation between those things.
Like, it doesn't connect the two. You don't get crossovers between... I mean, that would be a spoiler to say, I guess. But do you think there's a potential for that?
I don't think they will, Tom, because it's definitely set after Yakuza, like the main... This is the thing. Is it the main series, or are they just like the Kiryu arc versus like the Ichiban arc? I don't know how to refer to the old games. The previous Yakuza games have obviously been about the Tojo clan warring with the Omi Alliance and everything else. And this game so far has referenced both the Tojo clan and the Omi Alliance, but it isn't even set in Kamurocho. It is set in Yokohama. So it's a completely different city. Yeah. They've completely removed most of the aspects of it.
It's distancing itself from the old games in whatever ways it can, while still feeling like it's a Yakuza game.
Exactly.
It's in the Yakuza world.
You know what I mean? Like, there's still references to places in Yokohama because that's where Ichiban is from. There are still some subtle, like, nods and winks to the old Yakuza games because he is a character who's been in prison for 18 years. That's kind of the setup of the story, very much like the original Yakuza. Something happens and Ichiban takes the debt of going to prison for someone, much like Kiryu originally did in the first Yakuza game. And when he comes out, the world has completely changed. And so some of those things, like the soap land in Kamurocho, which is destroyed by Majima in the first Yakuza game, are referenced. And like, you see the effects that you had as Kiryu and everything else on the world. But they're not really in your face. And I don't think if you have not played the Yakuza game, they're going to get up in your face and you'll be like, why is this
this? As someone who has, that must be quite satisfying to see things that happen in those games reflected in this latest Yakuza game.
It definitely is. But like, I still don't know, and I think I'm at a point now where the story is starting to wrap back round on itself and become interesting again, because for a long time it felt like it was very much Yakuza for the first two or three chapters of the game. And it was very much like embroiled in, like, you are in the subsidiary of the Tojo clan and you're doing all these things. I was like, okay, this feels like the Yakuza I know and love. And then things change and you go to prison, you come out, and the world is completely different because obviously 18 years have passed. And you go to Yokohama, like I said, you end up escaping the city for reasons I will not spoil. And the world there is completely different, and it's trying its best in like two or three chapters to say, hey, this is what Yokohama is compared to Kamurocho. Like, these are the big players in this world. And it's trying to do a lot of world building very quickly. And this is why also I don't think I can remember any of the character names bar Ichiban, because it just introduces so much stuff so quickly on top of that. That it's just like, oh my god, who am I doing? What am I doing? What is the crack here? And it felt a lot like Yakuza 1 in the complaint I had when I replayed through that game recently when they released Kiwami, is that it just feels like there's a lot of shit they're introducing you to for the sake of it, because they need to build a world and they need to fill time in the same way I think they did with the first Yakuza game where they tried to introduce the triads and stuff. It's okay, but it's not like up there top tier Yakuza where Yakuza has been for the last couple of games.
Hmm.
Saying that though, now I'm on the sixth chapter and things have started to wrap back into that main storyline of why Ichiban is in Yokohama and everything else. It's started to get a bit more interesting and I'm kind of on board with it. It kind of took me that 12 hours or so. And to be honest with you, if you weren't doing on the side stuff like I was, it would probably take about 5-6 hours, I think, to get to this point.
I think you're the toughest audience for this, aren't you, though? As someone who's played all of them.
Yes.
I think people aren't that familiar with Yakuza and are coming to it, they might not have the same issues with it that you do.
No, exactly, and I think that's the weird thing. But to be fair, right, like, I try not to show bias towards the Yakuza games because I'm well aware that I am a big fan of that universe. I'm a big fan of the storytelling. And also, I really like JRPGs, so I should almost be predisposed to like this. And to be fair, I don't like the Mario and Luigi games, which is what the closest thing I have a parallel with this in combat in. Yeah, I'm still playing it and I've still gotten used to that battle system now because I like Yakuza that much. So, like, I'm giving it a bit more benefit of the doubt than I probably usually would. If this was a new game, had this been something I'd taken out of the library or bought and it had this battle system, I'd be like, oh no, I'm not really a fan of this, and I'd have probably dropped off it by now.
But you still would have been, I thought, drawn in by those things that you love about Yakuza.
Settings,
the characters, the story.
And that's why I think I'm still here. Yeah. And that's why I think now I'm on the path where I'm like, right, okay, cool. This is what this game is. I will accept it for what it is and I will play it that way. I do think that the JRPG stuff doesn't necessarily gel with how I want to play Yakuza either. In the fact you can't really roam around the city in the same way that you were able to in the previous games. Because certain areas have certain enemies that are too high a level. It isn't like... Obviously, this isn't a game where you're on a world map and you go from town to town and into dungeons and everything else. It's just a big city. So there are some bits of the city you can't go in. Because if you go down there, there'll be like level 30 enemies.
I always find that hard in RPGs, like Fallout. You know, first time I ever played Fallout... Fallout 3, wasn't it? Fallout 3 on the 360. You go off into the wilderness. You don't know where you should be going or what you should be doing, but you soon realise, I can't go that area yet because these enemies are too high a level.
Yeah.
And it feels in a way like it's punishing you. It's giving you all that freedom, but then it's saying, no, you can't do that. I was like, okay, so it's actually a relatively small world you're in because of that. Yeah.
Which, to be fair, right, I have found myself learning the streets of Yokohama perhaps a little bit faster than I have in other Yakuza games because of that. because I need to know where I can and can't go a little bit. Yeah. But I like just running around the city and exploring. Like, that's the thing I've always
loved
about this
series. Now there's danger around every corner. And it's not danger you can easily deal with, like in Yakuza normally.
No, exactly.
You can take down whoever's around.
To be fair, right, like, there are probably areas like this in Kamurocho in the original Yakuza games where there are harder enemies. But I just don't notice because I'm very good at that combat system.
Mm. Well, there is, thinking back actually, that tall character who will take all your money, you want to avoid him because he'll
the beatdown
guy. That's Yakuza Zero.
That's in Zero, yeah. And like, there are bigger characters and small characters and weedy characters and armed people and whatever in Yakuza, but like, you never really notice it that much, especially if you are as accustomed to the combat systems of those games as I am, because I can generally breeze through most fights, usually without getting hit. I'm quite good at the Yakuza combat system.
Because it can get quite intense.
They absolutely can.
At times, the fights, especially those big important fights, the one-on-ones with the key characters.
Yeah, absolutely. The boss fights in Yakuza games are usually quite hard.
I could have just said boss fights, couldn't I? I didn't know whether I could have called them a boss or not.
They're generally Yakuza bosses, so yeah, I think generally...
Yeah, that'll make sense for both things.
I like the game. I will say that. Like, I talked to some people who listen to this podcast on Twitter in the week, and they were like, I don't know if that's a good sign that you don't know how you feel about this game after playing it for like 12 hours. But I'm willing to go on record and say that I really like this game. It is. I don't know if it will be my favourite Yakuza game. I don't know if...
No, it doesn't sound like it.
It will have diminishing returns as it goes on, but let's see. I'm more than open to it, despite its flaws, despite some of the stupid stuff it does with, like, Psycho, the only female character in your party. Like, everyone else's weapon is a fucking baseball bat or a katana, and she has all of her job options are like, oh, you need to be an idol, or you need to be this and you need to be that, and like, there's some gender specific stuff going on where she's quite opposed to guys being lecherous and creepy in that game, and then she fights with a handbag. There's some weird mishmash of stuff there.
Has Yakuza ever been known for having strong female characters? Is that very much the world of Yakuza? It's a male-dominated
world. No, absolutely not. And to be honest with you, Saiko is quite a good character. She's quite a strong lady. Like, the reasons you get involved with her, I don't want to spoil stories, are very justified reasons that kind of, again, spark this idea of, like, well, maybe not everything's not right in Japan with how we treat the elderly and how the job prospects for someone in a big city if they don't have that much work experience or life experience. And it tackles those things really good, and she's a great character, but it's just, I don't know, there's some stuff where I don't think parts of that team talk to other parts of that team. Or maybe they tried to find levity in other things, like the weapons and the combat system, that I don't really think land that much. They don't get in the way enough, and they're not so ham-fisted that you're like, oh man, you are completely... You have tried to take a big swing at this storyline and completely missed it. But they're things I hope that they iron out as this series progresses, because they are blemishes on a game that I have some troubles with anyways.
I'm thinking about all the different covers of Yakuza games. You know. This definitely looks like the most fun, colourful, light-hearted cover, because you have a main character, I think he's smiling on the cover of the Western art, at least, isn't he? And I can't recall any Yakuza game prior to this having anything but a moody cover.
Yeah, but I mean, like, that's very...
They all
much
look mean
tone.
And moody.
I think that's the weird thing, because, like I said, the start of the game is very much that.
Yeah.
Even though, like, Ichiban is clearly like Naruto, and he's like, ah, I'm the goofball, and all these things are happening, and like, the reason his hair is like because of a funny side anecdote thing that happens in the story. Like,
oh, I've seen him in different variations with different length hair. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So like, they're definitely having more fun with him than I think you really could with Kiryu. Like,
and do you think
Kiryu
that was needed in Yakuza? Do you think it was needed to take a more light-hearted look at itself at this point? Or could it have just carried on being, like, at its heart, quite an intense drama.
I think it could have carried on being that, but to be honest with you, after playing, actually, I look at the difference between the Western box art and the Japanese box art, and it's quite striking.
I wonder what that's like.
Definitely, there is no smiles on Ichiban's face and an electric baseball bat behind him. It's very serious. It's more colourful, definitely, than the previous Yakuza covers, which have all been traditionally black and white in Japan. But it feels like a different game, but it's still very serious. It's still very like, Ichiban is looking stern.
Oh, he is, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. But it is definitely a more light-hearted game. I think, yes, this is a good thing for the series, because I think fans responded well to Akiyama, the guy from 4, and also to Majima. And I think maybe that's what they realised. They were like, okay, well, we can have all this drama and stuff, and this drama is probably even better when we have a goofball character get serious a la Naruto. So, I think it works. I'm all down for Ichiban. I think he's a cool character. I just hope that they manage to stick the landing on some of the stuff they're trying to do, and that also they can improve on this game going forward into Yakuza 8 or whatever they decide to do next.
Because it's called Yakuza 7 in Japan, isn't it? What's it called?
I need to just be able to say the Japanese name, because it's really bothering me. Ryo ga Gotoku, which means like a dragon.
It is like a dragon 7.
It is like a dragon 7, yeah. And it has it does have a subtitle though, which I will check what that is.
Yeah, that's interesting, because we've given it a different title, obviously, in the West. It's a very obvious title. that reflects what it's about.
Well, I mean, it's probably, I imagine that it's called Like a Dragon in Japan because there is stigma around the Yakuza, obviously. Like, whereas in the West, we see them as something that exists, but like the same way the Mafia does, is that it's something you can talk about. Whereas I think there is definitely a lot more taboo, and I don't really think that you walk around Japan talking about Yakuza, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no one will know what you're talking about if you're in Japan and you're saying, oh yeah, you played Yakuza.
Yeah, people will get freaked out probably. The Japanese subtitle, after a little bit of Googling, is Ryu ga Gotoku. Need to do my maths. Ryu ga Gotoku san. Nana, sorry. Hikari to Yami no Yukue. Literally, Like a Dragon 7. In between light and darkness.
Oh, he's in the middle ground.
He is, and that's very much the tone of the game. I like it, Tom. I will play more of it. I will beat it because it is a Yakuza game. I will let you know. But I'm very, 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 very curious to see if there's a Judgment 2 or a Yakuza 8 first, and if there is a Yakuza 8 before a Judgment 2, does Yakuza 8 revert back to that traditional turn-based comb? Is it going to stick with the turn-based, or is it going to revert back to the press square for...
I'd be very surprised if it reverted back. I'd say Judgment would probably continue that trend.
Me too. Yakuza. Let's see, though. Very curious.
Maybe there'll be a spin-off that will be like a side-scrolling beat-em-up or something.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I was thinking more like they do like another Fist of the North Star game or something like that, or they'd be like a... I don't know, they'd pick some other manga along those lines and be like, yeah, we're going to do like a Lupin game. But it's also got weird combat.
Possibly. Who knows? Who knows?
Exactly. What have you been playing, Tom? Because I've been playing two other games I could get into, but I want to let you talk, because I'm aware I've been talking for half an hour about Yakuza.
Fair enough, yeah. I've enjoyed the Yakuza chat, though. I hope everyone out there also enjoyed a bit of Yakuza. They know what to expect from this podcast. It's very Yakuza heavy. Of course, now I've been playing Shenmue 3, but I don't want to go into that too much. But I'm actually near the end of the game now. So
really?
I'm going to save my thoughts on Yakuza, Shenmue 3 until next time. Because by that time, I think I'll have finished it and I can give a proper sort of rundown of my feelings about that game. A game that I played for a little while this morning was Rise of the Tomb Raider.
Oh, really?
I decided to get back into Tomb Raider, namely because I picked up Shadow of the Tomb Raider in the Black Friday sale for £15, the definitive edition. But then I thought, well, I'm not going to play that yet, but I still feel like playing Tomb Raider. I should probably finish Rise of the Tomb Raider.
Yeah.
Now, I hadn't got very far in it, and you know my history with the Tomb Raider, more recent Tomb Raider games. It took me a while to finish the first one.
It took you like 6 years to finish the first one.
Like the Don't first, worry, one time
we talked about the first one on the first Tom and Matt attack, and I think you finished it around episode 200. So yeah,
I really did like it, but after finishing it, I wasn't ready to jump straight into playing the sequel because I imagined that it would be very familiar, a little too familiar.
Yes,
and it is similar. I don't know if you've played it. Have you, Rise of the Tomb Raider?
I have not. I actually saw it in a charity shop a couple of weeks ago. And I didn't pick it up because I had my hands full. And by the time I went back to pick it up, it had gone, which was annoying. And it also turns out that the woman who picked up The Rise of the Tomb Raider also picked up a red PlayStation 4 controller that I didn't bloody see either. So,
oh dear, getting all the goodies there. I must say I'm enjoying it. I like the style of gameplay of the more recent Tomb Raider games.
Yes.
I think it's very easy to pick up and play. See, I haven't played this for ages, and yet I could work out the controls really quickly.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. I like building up the weapons. It feels like you sort of start again. You know, in the original game, you know, obviously I'd upgraded all the weapons, but now so your bow's not so good, and you've got to now get the new power-up that'll let you attach it to some ropes so you can pull something, you know. All that sort of stuff. So it's building it right back up again. So it feels like a very similar experience so far. Yet it's in the snow.
Okay.
And the story's different, of course. But the problem is, because it's been a while since I started it, I can't remember why Lara's there in this snowy Russian environment. Something to do with Russians.
Okay.
And
something
snow.
Something to do with Russians and snow.
And Lara's dad was after something, and that's why Lara's there, because she's on the trail of this thing. And the Russians are looking for something, which could end up being the same thing.
Yeah. Probably.
I'm not doing a good job at describing the story. Gameplay-wise, though, same satisfying gameplay that I really enjoyed in the first one. But I wouldn't recommend playing it right off the back of the first one, just because it's so similar.
No, I mean, we talked about this when I did the Uncharted games.
Yeah.
It kind of drove me a bit mad by the time I got to, I almost said Yakuza 3, Uncharted 3, because that game, those games can be quite long, and there's a lot of repetition in what you're doing, and so once you kill someone or climb a wall for the 7,000th time, you're like, okay, I'm kind of over this, I just want to get to the cutscenes and figure out what's going on.
Am I right in thinking that down the line, Uncharted took some influence from Tomb Raider? Because that first Uncharted game, there's a lot of shooting.
Yes.
There's a lot of enemies. And there were moments in the first Tomb Raider game, in the first, more recent one, like that, where you had like hordes and hordes of enemies. So far in this one, I haven't encountered so much of that.
No.
And that's great. You know, there have been moments where there's been a few, but not the waves and waves like there were in the first Uncharted and, you know, occasionally in the Tomb Raider game. So I don't really like that, because I think that's just filling space.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and I always like to be moving towards the goal and exploring, you know, shoot a few guys and do a puzzle, then do some platforming, and the variety. I like that variety in the Tomb Raider games. I'd say, from what I've played of Uncharted, I prefer Tomb Raider.
Yeah. I would feel the same way. I think, from what I remember, the first three Uncharted games came out, then Tomb Raider came out, then it was a couple of years, and then Uncharted 4 came out around the same time as Rise of the Tomb Raider, and I think they both learned a lot from each other.
Yeah.
I am much more of a fan of the Tomb Raider games, I would say, because there's a lot of good stuff in Uncharted, but most of those games feel very dated, I would say. those first three especially. The story's good. The story is just like a good Indiana Jones film. But yeah, the gameplay's not really aged that well.
Yeah, what I really like about Tomb Raider is the amount of things you can pick up and collect, and then you can use them to upgrade your weapons. And that's a huge part of that gameplay for me. You know, and getting that next weapon will enable you to access a different area. Because already, now I've entered a more open area, I can see things that I can't do yet because I haven't got the fire arrows, for example. Yeah. And I know, oh, I can come back there and I can do that. So it's got a sort of open world bit. But then it's not an open world game, really. It's interesting. The first one was all on that island, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. This is...
But inside that island, there was a sort of more like scripted set pieces, which were the main storyline. But
yeah,
you were
absolutely.
Always encouraged to kind of go off the beaten track and do tombs and stuff.
There were a couple of tombs you could do, right? I think it was like 9 or so of them. They were like hidden under waterfalls and all of this kind of stuff, which was cool.
Yeah, and they're usually puzzle-based. I quite like those bits. Now, the puzzles aren't ever really that hard. But, you know, it does make you think a little, which I like about the Tomb Raider ones.
I like it a lot. I do want to go back and play Rise of the Tomb Raider and Shadows of the Tomb Raider. It's just about finding time, to be honest.
That is the real problem, I find. Time. You know, I don't think a game needs to be... Games need to be as long as they are, because I find they are padded out quite... You know, like with a film, you can watch it in a couple of hours. I've said this on the podcast numerous times. Yeah. But if every film was like 20 hours long, you wouldn't watch a lot of films. And the expectations on the player to spend that amount of time with one game when there are actually so many games out there. And they're like films now. They're like blockbuster films and they're trying to tell a story. But if you really want to tell a story, is a 20-hour game the best way of doing that?
Well, right, this is a debate.
Or more, you know. I don't know.
I have found recently, like, I haven't really watched that many films before the last couple of weeks, and in which I watched two or three, actually. We ended up watching Straight Outta Compton, Snowpiercer because of the Netflix series, and also the Jobs film with, what's his face, Michael Fassbender, not the one with Ashton Kutcher.
Yeah.
And I think they are all three very good films, in that they are... In the case of Jobs and Straight Outta Compton, obviously, they are telling a condensed history of real-life events that involved real people, and they are able to kind of communicate that history of what happened, admittedly in a dramatized way in some respects and a sugar-coated way in some others, but they are able to give you that feel of who these people were and what they did and why it was important very quickly. Snowpiercer was also a good film. I really enjoyed it. It's actually produced by Chak Pan-wook, the guy who did like Lady Vengeance and everything else. And it's kind of got a weird feel of being an American blockbuster, because you can tell there's money in it. It stars Chris Evans, Captain America. And also, it feels like a weird... European independent movie because it draws from a French comic, but it also feels like a Park Chan-wook movie in how stylized the action is and how dialed up to 11 a lot of stuff is. It's a really good film, but we started watching the series of it, which is kind of based on the comic, kind of based on the film. And they are able to go into more depth and more storytelling and more character building in that series, even though they aren't directly the same thing.
Because they got longer time to do it.
Because they got longer time to explore that world. My issue is, with 20-hour games, obviously you can tell broader stories. And to be honest with you, I'd said this to you off the mic, and I kind of want to capture it here. This is the reason I think that Yakuza 7 perhaps went towards JRPG. Is because there is a lot of story in those games, and I think they were like, hey, if this is a JRPG and the expectations are that this is a 40-hour game, we can make a 40-hour game and we can tell these stories. With a video game, though, I think it's a really delicate balance of, like, how much story can you tell in 20 hours, in 40 hours, in 60 hours in some cases with Final Fantasy? versus how much the player is playing and enjoying and feeling valued in that time, and how much is padding, needless exposition, needless side stuff, because you want the game to be long.
And that's where you've got to get the balance. Exactly. And I think not all games manage to do that very well. I think Tomb Raider, the first one, was too long.
Yeah, I would agree.
You've got to find that balance. And that is what I worry going into any game. Am I going to get to that point where it's just like, it's too long?
Yeah.
But RPGs, it is interesting what you say about RPGs. It's like Pokemon Sun and Moon. I never felt that was too long.
No.
If I'm going back and thinking about an RPG that I actually did get quite into and enjoy and complete. And I actually felt like the fact that I've spent this long with the characters.
Yeah.
It's funny saying this about Pokemon. But that you get to know them and it has more of an effect on you because you spend that long with them. Like a good long-running TV series or something. So it can be done.
Yeah.
I just don't think all games need to be as long as they are nowadays. Especially because I think Tomb Raider, it's mostly about the action, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
That game is about its gameplay and its action. And it's not necessarily about telling much of a story. You know, it is to a point, but it's not the main crux of it.
So was Gears of War, right? Like, Gears of War had a big story to tell over his three arcs. I played those games a lot. Like, the thing I remember about Gears of War is chainsawing people in multiplayer. Like,
exactly.
You've got to know what your game is. Yeah.
And I think nowadays every game is trying to be a blockbuster movie inside of a game.
Yeah. But again, right, this is why I fucking love Nier Automata, and why Nier Automata is the best game of the last 10 years, if not more, for me. Because Nier Automata does the rare thing that I've always hearkened on about in this podcast, is that Nier Automata generally tells a story you can only tell through a video game. And, like, the more we can do that, the more we can make games like Braid, like The Witness, to rub Jonathan Blow's ego, like Fez, like Nier Automata, the more we can make games that are true to the medium, that respect player time, and are telling a story that is unique to the medium of video games, the better we will be. Or, you know, the opposite, in just admitting that your game isn't a story game. It is just a game that you play some unique multiplayer, or you play puzzles. Like, you don't need... Sometimes the act of playing and the act of progression through getting more difficult is enough.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure there is one, but you don't need, like, a Tetris game where every like seven levels you get a cutscene explaining like why the rocket's being built. That could be quite funny, actually. Of just like, we need the rocket fuel, we need to do this. Oh god, the world's gonna explode. But I mean, it doesn't
skip
need
that.
It, does it? Exactly. And I mean, Bubble Bobble, right? Like, it is gaming in its purest. All Bubble Bobble is like, it tells you at the start, it's like, hey, you're about to go on an adventure, you need to save the princesses. That's it. All you need.
That's what games used to be like that I played growing up, because I didn't play RPGs. I didn't play games which were actually setting out to tell some sort of grand story. However, something like Ninja Gaiden did, didn't it? Introduced cutscenes back in the day. And that was an action platform game, but it had a story.
And it was trying to be Hollywood, wasn't it? Because everything was in like, everything was letterbox format and everything else in widescreen.
Yeah.
And like, it was trying to emulate that. And I've read a couple of books in the past about video games and like why video games are important as an art form and all of this. Fortunately, that tired conversation has ended. But a lot of their critique of video games at that time in the early 2000s was video games should try and stop being films and try and be their own thing. And I can't agree more with that, because to be honest with you, they're going to release an Uncharted movie in the next 2 years starring Tom Holland.
Yeah.
And then
Nathan Drake.
Yeah, as a young
prequel,
Nathan Drake.
Isn't it?
And to be honest with you, they could then just go on and make the rest of the Uncharted games into films. I would never have to play them again. And I would get the same thing out of it as I did playing those games.
Now, I feel like you could tell the story of Shenmue 3 in a two-hour movie.
Yeah.
However, something about Shenmue is its sense of place, and it's a sense of repetition,
yes.
And it's a sense of getting... of characters being familiar, and that yes. you're on a long journey. The journey wouldn't feel as long if you were able to tell the story in such a short time.
Yes. But then, is Shenmue, like, admittedly, I do think Shenmue falls into the category of, like, towing the line of being a game that is doing stuff that only a video game can, for better or for worse. Like, there are purposeful things why it takes you so long to do stuff, because it's trying to incentivize
emulate
you
life.
As a player, the feeling of life, yeah, and the time yeah. of time passing.
Yeah.
And obviously, like, I don't know the intentions of the Yakuza, the bloody hell, I'm doing it now, the Shenmue team. But I've been reading a lot of Japanese fiction as of late, and a lot of the more famous and more successful Japanese works of fiction are very slice of life. They're not always crazy over the top things, and yeah, visual novels do exist, and like light novels exist as well that are very like shonen focused and like about fantasy and things. But much like, I mean Anna Karenina and like all of Russian literature is a very slice of life as well, so maybe this just doesn't apply. But I do think that Shenmue is trying to do that kind of slice of life feel that you can get out of a novel in a video game.
Hmm. Yeah, I often say there's nothing quite like Shenmue.
No.
Because I guess some people consider the types of things you do in Shenmue, and they are sometimes, to be boring and repetitive.
Yeah.
But it's that repetitiveness that is what makes Shenmue.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, you can't just jump from one exciting thing to another. It's like you need to work to earn money in order to do this. I think Shenmue 3 took it a little bit too far by saying you need to eat all the time.
Yeah.
Which is sort of like, I need money to eat now, but I also need money to progress in the story, to purchase this item, to get further, and there's too much of it. But I think, to a point, it really works in Shenmue's favour to make it a unique experience that emulates real life.
I totally agree, and I think some of that stuff though is kind of going back to what we talked about, right? Because Fallout games, especially from New Vegas, and I think the original two Fallout games have a hardcore mode in which you have to eat and all this, and that sounds really cool on paper. You're like, oh my god, how realistic. But then when you actually have to deal with it as a player, it's usually a frustrating thing. To have to worry about food and have to worry about stamina levels and all this. You just want to play the game, and it was one of those things that I run into playing Moon. But Moon is also trying to do some stuff that I think only a game can. You know, like I want more experiences that are quirky, short things that are experimenting with the medium of games and telling stories that games can.
The more I think about Shenmue, it's like, what's going to happen today? Every time I play, it's like a day in the life of Ryo. He's going to wait. What should I do today? What should I put on my list of things to do? Well, I have to do some work. So I'll do some forklift driving. And then I go and maybe do some fishing.
Yeah.
And then, oh yeah, I'll go and progress the story a bit. But before I can do that, I need to do these things. And then, okay, so then you go to bed at the end of the day. And you say, oh yeah, I've accomplished something today. But tomorrow I'm going to accomplish even more.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's very unique, but it's maybe it's familiar to something like... does Animal Crossing have day and night cycles?
Yes.
Or days in Animal Crossing?
Yes,
there
does,
are, aren't
but
there?
But, like, there's no story to drive in Animal Crossing. Obviously, the story is your own. And so
I think if Animal Crossing had some sort of story that it was leading up to, I might be more inclined to play it.
Well, Tom Parry, have I got a game for you? I haven't played it yet, but I have heard... Well, I mean, to be fair, that's kind of Rune Factory, that's kind of Harvest Moon, is that you were designing an area and there's a story that goes on around it. There's a game I purchased that I have still shrink-wrapped because I've got too many other games on my plate at the moment called Sakuna of Rice and of Ruin, which seems to tick that box. in that it's a side-scrolling action game with like crafting and about or having a farm, but there's also like gameplay and story and stuff on top of that. I mean, there is somewhat of a story between Animal Crossing because, I mean, you are paying for your house and, like, it's about, like, interacting with your villagers and overhearing conversations with them. Like, the story of Animal Crossing is, for example, me and my wife looking yesterday as Kabuki, our Japanese Kabuki-inspired cat, played the saxophone. And it was just a small thing of, like, walking around the island. Martha had put a saxophone out somewhere. And it turns out that occasionally now we'll find Kabuki the cat playing the saxophone, and we
so you make your own stories in a way. Yeah,
exactly. Like that's what
like
it's
the
about.
Sims
player-driven narrative in exactly the same way as the Sims, but there's less. It's less about speed and progression in Animal Crossing.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm going to talk briefly about a game.
Yes, please.
That kind of lends itself to this argument and why stories and games aren't always the best thing. I, Tom Parry, I told you about this, and I was glad that you had a very similar experience to this game than I did. I looked at the PlayStation sales around Halloween, and there was an indie sale on, and as I mentioned, some stuff was going on in my life, and I was like, I'm gonna play a video game. I want something short and sharp that I've heard is very good. Won a lot of Game of the Years, won a lot of praise in like top 10 things from like Giant Bomb and Waypoint.
You can't go wrong, yeah? That's what
you
thought.
I can't go wrong. I love a good hard 2D platformer. I'll pick up Celeste because at the moment, Celeste was. I wanted to buy Spelunky 2 because I'd heard good things about Spelunky 2 and I'd finished off Hades. I was like, right, I need to get. Oh, actually, by the way, add to the argument, Hades, another game that's fantastic that tells a story you can only tell in a game. Good job, Supergiant.
And doesn't
They're
feel too long.
No, doesn't it doesn't, because it's run-based. Yeah. It's amazing. I picked up Celeste. I was like, okay, I'm going to get through this. I hear this isn't a very long game. I hear it's like 4 or 5 hours. Let's do this. I have never been as frustrated as a video game in modern memory as I have with Celeste. And I've had some time away from it. The reason we didn't do a podcast last week in particular was I'd played Celeste. I'd had enough stuff going on emotionally on top of it that I was like, is my feeling of absolute vile hatred towards Celeste me being in a bad place right now, or is it I just really don't like Celeste?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's probably somewhere in between, if I'm being honest. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff I do like about Celeste. I think the story is quite quirky. I really like the music of Celeste. The art is gorgeous. I fucking hate playing that game, however, and so I watched all of the story on YouTube so I could figure out what happened in the story and get the message of it.
Because it's just too difficult.
It isn't even that it's too difficult, Tom, because I could live with the difficulty. So for those of you who don't know, Celeste is a 2D side-scrolling platformer. Is it about a girl trying to climb a mountain, or is it ? And
vertically scrolling.
Yeah, along this vertically scrolling game, your task is to climb a mountain. You run into people along the way. You can talk to. It's all very whimsical. It all feels very indie. It's by Matt Makes Games, who are the people who do Towerfall, so I love Towerfall. And it controls and feels very similar to that. There's a the main mechanic of it is you can jump and then you have a dash. And it's about trying to like time those things perfectly.
I think scrolling was the wrong thing to say. Scrolling implies that the screen moves. Actually, in Celeste, you're moving vertically.
It's fixed screens,
but it's screen.
Yeah.
It's a fixed screen. It's screen by screen. Like to me, each screen is like a little challenge.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And the thing is with Celeste, and to be fair to the people who made the game, they do say, hey, there are strawberries in this world. You do not have to get them. There is no benefit for you getting these strawberries other than bragging rights. They will not unlock anything. They don't affect the game. They're just here as an extra challenge if you want that. That's all well and good. If you put a collectible on a screen, Tom, I'm like a moth to a flame. I can't help myself. I need to get that fucking strawberry. Also, they are like, hey, look, this game can get quite frustrating. It is meant to. It is a hard game. Come back Like, you will save at every screen. You can always just come back and do it.
Hmm.
My issue with Celeste is perhaps the reason I fell off things like Meat Boy every now and again is that there are worlds and like bigger levels in Celeste that are apart from these screens where you are going through them trying to get story and whatever. Each one of them is a very, very hard puzzle a la a Super Meat Boy level. But they scroll into each other. You know what I mean? Like, so once you beat one very hard puzzle, you'll get either up or off to the right, and then there will be another very hard puzzle. And the way you play Celeste is essentially you throw yourself at this puzzle as many times as it takes you to get a clear run. And
there's
then
not lives, you said. It's infinite.
It's infinite lives. And like you can do it as many times as you want. And you save, just like Meat Boy. But there's no like... With Meat Boy, I think the lizard part of my brain really enjoyed me clearing a really hard level after like 100 deaths and like the good job and watching all the ways I'd fucked up and died. Just being like, oh yeah, I remember that run.
Where I suggest Celeste just move straight on to the next thing.
Exactly. And I never felt with Celeste, and this is why sometimes I like hard games, right? I never had the feeling with Celeste that either things were my fault because I couldn't really get a grip on how to dash properly at different angles. And so sometimes, like, there are bits in that game where you will dash and you'll hit, like, a diamond, which will give you another dash. And sometimes I just skim past that diamond. And I was like, I aimed at that diamond. Like, I can't see a way I could have hit that diamond better in my head. And it could be the frustration. It could have been where I was as a person last week. But there are just bits about it that don't reward you. You don't feel like you ever are on a run with Celeste in the way that you do in a Hades or you do even in a Spelunky 2, which I've played. It just felt like banging my head against something
until you fail. Yeah.
And then I got through that bit of failure and then I banged my head at something again. And like, there's only so much head banging one can do in a game session before you get really tired. I don't know, man. Like, all of the whimsy and charm of that game, for me, is completely ruined by how difficult it is and how it gets in its own way. I don't know. For me,
but if you weren't collecting all them strawberries, do you think it would be any easier?
Honestly, I fucked off the strawberries at the end of the third world because I was like, right, I can't do this. I just need to play this game. I want to know the story. And then the fourth world was just so fucking difficult that I was like, I have better things to do with my time. Like, I am playing a game at the moment in very much realization that this should be escapism. I do not want
not punishment.
Extra stress on top of what I'm currently going through. So I turned it off. It did nothing for me in terms of gameplay.
Developers maybe need to learn this lesson. Or do you think there's enough people out there who are wanting to play something so punishing, so frustrating?
I mean, there clearly
are.
There
is an audience for this.
There clearly are because it won awards. And they're clear, like... But I just need to be clear, right? Like, we've talked about
Dark
Souls.
But this is the hardcore. You've got to be hardcore to get to stick with something like that.
Yeah, and I am usually that person. I will play Hades 800 times to see credits. I will, you know, like, admittedly, I have not beaten a Dark Souls game, but I understand Dark Souls now, and like it, Dark Souls is Mega Man argument that I've gotten a lot of times in this podcast. I understand why that game is satisfying, and I have played enough Bloodborne to realize going from A to B. And just, like, mastering how to, like, get to a boss and to beat the boss and to progress.
It's satisfying. I felt that thing with Mega Man. You know, I remember we talked about in the podcast that realization of what Mega Man is and why people like it.
Yeah.
Is the satisfaction you get from working out how to play it properly. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't get that from Celeste. I think that the little vignettes of the levels are, A, really hard. Which is again, like I said, it's fine. I could beat them. It wasn't a thing where sometimes I would get really frustrated that I felt that I was doing everything right and I wasn't. Like, I could get through them. It just became, they're so small and they're so challenging for being a small area that you never get that flow you get from a Mega Man or a Souls, where you're just like, yeah, I'm fucking nailing this. Look, I haven't died in like 3 minutes.
You can't get in flow in Celeste.
No,
flow is an important state for any gamer to get into, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, it's important for anything, right? A creative process or anything. You need to feel that you are being met halfway, and I just don't get that with Celeste at all.
I totally get what you're saying. And I think many would be able to relate to that. We'd be interested to hear if you've got your experiences on a game like Celeste. You know?
Yeah, let us know. I am Manning at TMA Cast again, so you can tweet us there and I will reply. I may even post on that account off the back of this podcast, unpopular take, Celeste is a really bad game. I wouldn't go that far. I think there are things about Celeste. It's just I can't get over how brutally difficult and how punishing it is. And I thought about this while I was playing it, and it's like, I had some bad news after I started playing Yakuza Like a Dragon, and like half of me always thinks, like, because of the way we see the world and the way that we consume media, I will always tie certain songs, certain games, certain films to certain points in my life, and like, for better or for worse, those two games, Celeste and Like a Dragon, will always be timed to this time of my life, I think. But I wish it were a positive memory that it was hung on. Because I think if I would have played this and I was in a better state, I would just immediately bounced off it and say Celeste is not for me.
It's unfortunate, because everything, you've been led to believe this was going to be a really good game to play. It's going to be fun. It's really going to be good for you.
I knew it was going to be hard too. And like, to be honest with you, I wouldn't have minded a hard game, because to test the series out, immediately after deleting Celeste, because I literally was like, no, I'm not playing this. I deleted it. I watched the YouTube stuff for the story. Immediately after doing that, I started playing Spelunky 2, which is a lot harder than Spelunky 1 is, but it's still Spelunky. I could still get 3 or 4 down to like World 2, die, and be like, okay, cool, but I had fun getting here. One more go.
You had fun. That's the key thing. You had
exactly.
fun.
Exactly. I had fun dying. It wasn't as frustrating as Celeste was, for like no real reason other than to be difficult, I think. Mm-hmm. So it goes. I'm very curious, by the way, I forgot to mention, I picked up Aegis 13 Sentinels as well.
Oh, yeah.
The RTS come visual novel from VanillaWare, which I'm very looking forward to arriving. It sounds like a good game. And from what I have heard of the story over the last week, I've heard people on podcasts sing the praises of that game in the same way they have of Nier Automata. And while I knew nothing about the story, someone said something about the story in one of these podcasts. I was like, oh my God, is that what the game's about? That's amazing. And so I'm really curious to play it now. But I got you.
I'll be interested to hear your thoughts on that. One game at a time, isn't it? That's how it feels like nowadays. It's like they're so long, and they're so unique in a way. They control slightly differently that when you jump between games, sometimes it's like, oh yeah, how do I play that? I forget now. I say thankfully it wasn't like that with Tomb Raider, but you do get some games where it's like, oh yeah, how do I play this? But there you go. I don't like to play one game at a time, Matt. You know me. I like to dip in and out of different games.
Yeah, me too.
And that's why I find it a little frustrating that how much time certain games demand. Because I really enjoyed playing Spider-Man a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. I played it for a couple of hours. Oh, it was great. Then it's like, I don't feel like playing Spider-Man today. I feel like playing Tomb Raider.
Yeah. No,
but now I've got to relearn Spider-Man again when I next feel like playing it. I don't like the idea of being forced that, oh, I should really play this again this week because I started it the other week and I should stick with this one game.
To be fair, I'm doing that with Yakuza at the moment because I want to play Yakuza and I want to beat it. But like, usually I'd be the same. Usually I'd have 2 or 3 things on the go.
Well, I get it with Yakuza and I get it with Shenmue because you're following a story and you're wrapped up in the story. In Spider-Man, of course, there's a story, but it's another one of those games where I think it's about the gameplay. It's about the swinging around and the action. Now, listeners can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know how good and involving the story is, but it's sandwiched between large chunks of open world
gameplay.
Action.
Yeah.
And therefore, it isn't like a Yakuza or a Shenmue where it's, you know, very much about just getting to that next story beat as, you know, quick as you can.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the case, because there's distractions in both those games, but you don't have to do them. You know, you don't have to do all the side quests, and you don't have to get every collectible in Shenmue 3, and I'll talk about that next time, because that game you could play forever. The amount of stuff there is to collect in that game, and I don't see the point in collecting it, which is the thing.
Yeah.
Why do you need all this junk?
Yeah, you could do.
There's
stuff
so
like
much
that,
to buy. I don't. I really don't get it.
No, I know. I'm the same as you. Like, some people just like there's like mini in-game achievements for like spending over like 2 million yen and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, oh, I don't care that much. Like,
yes, yeah. A lot of the achievements on Shenmue 3 are get all of these, spend this amount of money, have this amount of money. Buy all of these items, get all of these collections. Can just be a collectathon if you want it to be.
I mean, like, if you really want to rinse your money's worth out of it, like, I did that with the Yakuza 6. Like, I got a fucking lot of those in-game achievements in Yakuza 6. Other than the Mahjong one, which still annoys me that I still haven't got the Mahjong one. There's a weird glitch with my Yakuza 6 game where you need to do... Essentially, you need to have, like, the perfect game. And obviously, in a game like Mahjong, where it's random chance, it's very hard to do. So there's an item you can save up for, and then it makes the perfect game for you. Like, it does it for you, but it's really expensive.
I see.
And it's an item to unlock an achievement. For some reason, no matter how many times I boot up that save file and do that perfect game, it never triggers the achievement. It's really annoying. So, like, that's the only reason I haven't got a platinum. I can't remember if it's Yakuza 6 or Judgment, but one of them I'm super close to a platinum in. Ah. Oh, well. That's how it goes.
Okay.
You bought or played anything else of note?
I think we should bring it to a close. The only thing that I really wanted to say was something I've been thinking about for over the past week. Isn't the Wii U, a lot like the Xbox Series X?
How's that?
My thinking is, you know, it's branded the same.
Yeah.
It's branded confusingly, so it doesn't really sound like one or the other.
Yeah.
It allows you to play your old games.
Right.
So it becomes the perfect way to play your old games. It's an upgrade console.
Right.
It doesn't, you know, rewrite the, you know, what was it, reinvent the wheel. I know that the Wii U, you could argue it has a gamepad, so it was trying to do something a bit different. But, you know, there's similarities, I think, between the two, and it makes me wonder why the Wii U wasn't as successful as it could have been, because really it was an upgrade to the Wii.
Yeah, but I think that people saw the Wii U as a peripheral for the Wii, is a lot of what I heard.
It was to do with how it was marketed.
Exactly.
Yeah. But really, essentially what it was, though, is similar to what the current consoles are. They're upgrades that allow for better graphics, you know, improvements over your old game library. I mean, when I say improvements, I mean on the Wii U, Wii games maybe look a little better than they would on the Wii. But, yeah, I just something I thought about. The throwaway statement for the end of this podcast. What do you guys think of that idea that the Wii U was the first of those type of upgrade consoles, which I very much see this new generation as being?
I disagree with you, but if you do agree or with either of us, you can let us know on Twitter at TMAcast. You can spam Tom Abuse or at Tom Parry 11 and go, yeah, Matt, you're right. It's completely not like that at Game Boy. No, I kid. I get what you mean. I do think that this is a proper topic of conversation, though, but one we can get into next week. If you have anything else to say, you can also do it at those places, or you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TomAndMattAttack. You can go to our Blast Process site, Blast Process, which is where the podcast will be hosted. You can go to God, I'm out of practice of doing this. It's the first time I've ever messed this up. You can go to tomattack.com/podcast where you can find it. You can also listen to us on iTunes and Stitcher, wherever the podcast is made. Please give us a cheeky rate and subscribe on your iTunes and let us know you're listening, etc., etc. And that, even though I flubbed this bit up, that you will forgive us for not doing a podcast for a couple of weeks. Okay, Tom, it is always a pleasure, mate, and I will speak to you soon.
A pleasure indeed.
But until then, everybody out there, and see you, Mr. Parry, be sure to game on.
Game on. We'll be right back.